wish you the best of luck in the new year, and I'm very grateful to you for taking part in our annual press conference. I don't think I should spend a lot of time on my introductory remarks. Just recently, the president gave a big end of the year press conference, and just a few days ago, President Putin met with the editors-in-chief of Russian media and news agencies. I think you've been following these major events, and you're well familiar with the president's comments on various issues, including foreign policy. So I'll just say briefly that once again, we have to say that this year was not easy. We see various hot spots around the world, in the Middle East, Northern Africa, and Ukraine, our neighboring country. And in the recent months, we saw serious escalation because of the threats coming from Washington, threats to solve the nuclear issue on the Korean Peninsula through the use of force. We heard similar threats regarding Afghanistan, again, using force to resolve the problem, and of course, last statements intended to disrupt Joint Comprehensive Plan on the Iranian nuclear program further destabilizes the situation. Unfortunately, our U.S. partners and their allies still want to conduct affairs through dictating and ultimatums. They're unwilling to listen to other centers of international politics, and they refuse to acknowledge the emerging multipolar world. The methods they use to deter their rivals are, for a large part, from the deployment of the global missile defense system, unilateral sanctions, extraterritorial application of its laws, and, like I said, threats to resolve international issues based on their own scenario, including even the use of brutal military force. As a result, we see international law being undermined, international institutions losing their significance, and more states building up their military might, which they regard as almost the only guarantee of preserving their sovereignty under current circumstances. Therefore, we've been doing our best to protect Russia's national interest in international affairs, including the interests of our people, the interests of Russian companies, which often are being discriminated against. And simultaneously, we do our best to protect international law, the international system based on the UN Charter. Working together with other constructive forces internationally, we've been upholding universal values of truth, mutual respect, and cooperation, doing our best to prevent the degradation of the international world order, which is seriously upset today. And we want to do our best to prevent the world from descending into chaos and confrontation. Specific areas of our work, I'll comment on that when I answer your questions. I will only mention right now that this year, this new year, we will continue with our efforts in all those areas. This includes fighting terrorism. We saw serious progress with that in Syria, and currently Syria is at an important stage, moving on to political dialogue, and we've been working together with Turkey and Iran, preparing for a Syrian Dialogue Congress. where a wide range of Syrian forces will be participating as required by the UN Security Council Resolution 2254. We will continue working on the Iranian nuclear deal. We will seek normalization of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, the Middle East conflict. Conflicts problems are further complicated by the fact that the Palestinian issue has not been resolved. Of course, we will also continue working on Ukraine, a problem which can only be resolved by fully implementing the package of measures adopted in Minsk in February 2015. Of course, we have a very important political event coming up, the presidential election. Our embassies, consulates, and cultural centers abroad will do everything necessary for Russian people currently abroad to be able to vote conveniently. I stop here, and now I will start the interactive part of our conversation.
Anna Baldina, Russia 24 TV station. As you might know, the media publishes the rating of top words, of top 10 words of the previous year. What would be your rating?
Well, for the fear of being misunderstood, I will not talk about specific words. As far as stories are concerned, it's, of course, Syria. This is a problem where many interests of many players converge. And, like I said, we do our best. There is this initiative of the Syrian Dialogue Congress. We do our best to harmonize the interests of all the Syrian parties and all the external players that can influence the situation, all those who would like to advance their interests in the region as part of the Syrian process. This is a complex process, but like I said, we have reasons to believe that the group of Russia, Iran, and Turkey, which was able a year ago to launch the Astana process, to set up the de-escalation zones, and despite all the attempts to undermine these efforts, this initiative still proved quite effective. And the Astana process also stimulated the United Nations activity. Before we started the Astana process, the UN process did nothing for about 10 years. So I hope that the initiative of the Syrian National Dialogue Congress will also stimulate the UN to step up its efforts. In any case, the Sochi Congress pursues the goal of helping the Geneva talks, and we clearly said as much to our colleagues, including the UN leadership and the countries involved in the Syrian settlement. The second story of the year, I guess, the Middle East in general, the Middle East and Northern Africa, because Syrian settlement is just a part of a very complex nexus of problems existing in this region. I can mention Libya, Yemen. I've already mentioned the Palestinian-Israeli settlement, which is experiencing a deep crisis. And I still remain convinced that as regards the influence of the dead end in the Palestinian-Israeli settlement, the dead end in setting up a Palestinian state, this has a very negative effect on the radicalization of the Arab street. Ukraine is another subject which artificially is overinflated and is regarded by some as the grinding stone in the relations between Russia and the West. I think it is an absolutely politicized and erroneous approach, and I wish they could abandon such a view, such a prism, which they use to view the Ukraine crisis. The prism of confrontation between the quote-unquote authoritarian Russia and the quote-unquote democratic West. Instead, we should focus on the Minsk agreements, because they're extremely clear. And they don't allow any double interpretation, different interpretations. If only we could focus on this, we would be able to resolve this conflict. We would not use ideological interpretation of the situation as something that means a lot to relations between Russia and the West. This would allow our Western partners to abandon their unconditioned support for Kyiv, which disrupts the Minsk agreements. This is another story of the year. I can also mention some positive trends. The Eurasian integration, the implementation of the Greater Eurasia project, including Eurosec, SCO, ASEAN. This project is open to new participants in the East and in the West alike. Of course, we need to broaden this process, APEC, G20, BRICS. These are groupings which embody the trends of the modern world, the objective process of the polycentric system of international relations emerging. Of course, I may have forgotten something I should mention, but these are the stories we keep working on a daily basis.
Mr. Lavrov, I'm from Xinhua News Agency. The leaders of Russia and China said that they would like to continue cooperate on international affairs just before the new year. So what are the major international issues where Russia is counting on China? The Shanghai Cooperation Organization will have its next summit in June in China. What are your expectations?
See, I'm very grateful to the moderator for letting you go second, because you mentioned the subject which I did not mention when answering the first question regarding the stories of the year. Of course, the nuclear problem of the Korean Peninsula is one of the most serious issues today. And Russia and China have been working together closely on this matter. As you know, we have a joint initiative with China regarding a way to move from confrontation to a political settlement. To begin with, we suggest that everybody should calm down and freeze any confrontational actions, especially conducting military drills and launches of missiles, nuclear tests, and large-scale maneuvers conducted by the United States together with the Republic of Korea and Japan. So once there is this moratorium in place, such a ban on hostile actions, we will actively support direct contacts between the interested parties, including, first and foremost, of course, Pyongyang and Washington. And we will also provide support for this bilateral dialogue as part of the so-called six-party process, involving also Russia, China, Japan, and the Republic of Korea. This, I think, is the most important item on the Russia-China agenda. I would also like to say that our working on this matter is not easy. Like I said, the United States says openly about the need for a military solution, even though everybody is aware of dire consequences of such reckless action. And in a situation where there was a window of opportunity for a dialogue, we saw provocative action, like military drills around North Korea, which provoked further escalation. We have a joint roadmap together with China, and we will work based on it. We also work together on the Syrian settlement. Our Chinese colleagues share Russia's position on this matter. What I mean is, they believe that the conflict can only be resolved through political means based on the UN Security Council decision, which says there should be political dialogue without any preconditions, involving all the forces in Syria, including the government and all key opposition movements, reflecting the diversity of the Syrian population, ethnically and religiously. We have also another important joint initiative with China. It's a draft treaty on non-deployment of weapons in space. We put it forward several years ago at the UN Disarmament Conference. Unfortunately, because of the position of the United States, this treaty is not currently being discussed. All the other countries understand that this is an important matter, but the United States continues to make plans to militarize space in the sense of deploying weapons in outer space, which, of course, will make international security issues much, much more difficult. By the way, at the Disarmament Conference, China co-sponsored the draft of another important document, Convention on Prevention of the Use of Chemical and Biological Weapons for Terrorist Purposes. And again, surprisingly, the United States opposed this move. And finally, in Eurasia, we have been working closely together, consolidating our efforts for integration. China has its own initiative called One Belt, One Road. The President of Russia and the Chairman of China have agreed to promote coupling of Eurasian integration and the One Belt, One Road initiative. Members of the Eurasian Economic Union have been working together on a treaty on a trade deal with China. Simultaneously, we see contacts between Eurasec and the SCO. We're also open for ASEAN countries to join in. A number of ASEAN countries have signed their agreements with the EAEU, free trade zone agreements, or talks are underway. On the whole, this is what President Putin calls the Greater Eurasia Project. This looks very promising. Of course, we have to consider a number of important factors because there are a lot of economic interests at stake. But everybody, this initiative looks so promising because it's based on real life. It doesn't set up a specific framework in advance and then moves on to practical things. No. The way we do it is, I can give you a metaphor. You know how they lay paths in England. First, they see where people find it comfortable for them to walk, convenient for them to walk, and then after that they make pathways. This is the way we work on the Greater Eurasia Project. I can give you a long list of other initiatives that Russia and China have in common, but I think I can stop here. I've mentioned the key items where we work together.
Mr. Lavrov, in 1988, Russia ratified an agreement on friendship and partnership with Ukraine. I guess it was 1998, but in 2014 this agreement is no longer relevant, but it was automatically prolonged for 10 years if it's not denounced. And you have to do it. What will you do? Will you automatically prolong this agreement, or will you denounce this agreement? And again, you're an expert in international affairs. What's your advice to your leadership? I did not get your second part. So, what will you do? Will Russia denounce this treaty, or will it automatically prolong it? Or if you don't know yet what Russia will do, what will you, as an authority, as an expert in international affairs, what will you advise to your leadership? Well, if I don't know what to advise, how will I advise? Well, jokes aside, I got your question. We have one MP, Konstantin Zatulin, who raised this issue the other day. He said that one of these sections was on respect for territorial sovereignty, territorial integrity and sovereignty, and this provision is no longer relevant because Crimea had a referendum and the people of Crimea decided to become independent and then join Russia. Well, for me this is not really a relevant issue. International documents are important, but it's up to the lawyers. Politically, we continue to respect territorial integrity of Ukraine in the borders following the Crimea referendum after Crimea reunited with Russia. There have been many legalese questions on that, including on the Budapest Memorandum, according to the Budapest Memorandum, Ukraine said it will no longer have its nuclear stock, and again, we've never threatened Ukraine with nuclear weapons, so it means that there have been no violation of the Budapest Memorandum. But in a separate protocol, Ukraine said it will not provoke racist or neo-Nazi or xenophobic trends. But what happened after the Maidan protests was a gross violation of that commitment. But politically, I assure you, now, as President Putin reiterated once again, we seek the full implementation of the Minsk agreements without any omissions, and that is fully in line with our respect for territorial integrity of Ukraine and its current borders following the Crimea referendum that was held in fully in line with international law.
But we are talking about the 1998 borders and territorial integrity in terms of 1998. So maybe this treaty needs to be modernized.
With all due respect, the issue that you just raised only distracts us from the bottom line. The bottom line is that Ukraine has subscribed to the Minsk Accords, and the Minsk Accords have nothing to do with Crimea, and these accords need to be implemented. We need to focus on pushing the Kyiv authorities to deliver on what they committed to, and what is also part of the UN Security Council resolution. I don't think we should diverge and discuss what we should do with this international treaty. I think that the Minsk Accords are much more important, and again, it was unanimously approved by the UN Security Council. We know from our private conversations, our colleagues' counterparts in the West fully understand the tactics of the Kyiv authorities towards the Minsk Accords. They see that our Ukrainian neighbors have made repeated attempts to use force to resolve the situation. But in fact, what they do is they just ignore the efforts that need to be taken as part of the Minsk Accords. So I don't want us to hypothesize. I don't want it to be seen as disregard for international law. But actually, international law was ignored and disregarded by those who stoked up the Maidan protests. Back in February 2014, an agreement was reached between then-President Mr. Yanukovych and leaders of the opposition, and it was signed in the presence of foreign ministers of Germany, Poland and France. But the next day, it was torn to pieces by the opposition. But the Western counterparts that were present at the signing ceremony, they've actually betrayed the Ukrainian nation, because the agreement put forward a national unity government, and instead they had the government of winners, as Mr. Yatsenyuk said. And then there was an MP convention that united, brought together MPs of the East and the South, and they decided to assume authority and control over their territory. So they never took any military action, but on the 23rd of February, the National Parliament passed a law on the languages, and was a Russophobic, anti-Russian law, and they sent a signal. And on the 26th of February, the coup leaders sanctioned the use of force by the right sector and Hizb ut-Tahrir organization and the Wahhabi organization to storm the Supreme Council building, the Parliament building of Crimea. So it was 5 days after European leaders were not able to push the Kyiv authorities to deliver on their commitments. So, again, 5 days after the coup, the Kyiv authorities sanctioned the use of force against the Crimea Parliament. And again, the referendum movement started after that, when Crimeans realized they could have nothing to do, and they want to have nothing to do with the Kyiv authorities. So again, the use of force is a and the sanctioning of the use of force is a clear violation of the Budapest Memorandum of international law. So Russia subscribes to international law, but first of all, We would like those who violated it first to sober up and behave accordingly.
Vladimir Solovyov, Kommersant. In January, there was a poll conducted by the Levada Center, and 68% of the Russian people said the United States was a hostile country. Situation is somewhat similar. It's 64% to 72% of the American people who view Russia as an enemy. Could you please comment on these sad figures and maybe answer the question whom or what we should blame for seeing enemies in each other?
President Putin made multiple statements on this issue. It's not an egg and chicken problem. Rather, it's a problem of your opinion, of your worldview. The Americans are known for their feeling of exceptionalism and superiority. President Obama mentioned that several times. President Trump has not said that, but the efforts and steps by the elite and the American leadership worldwide clearly indicates that they still rely on this mentality. It would be one thing if there would be positive examples, if they had fair competition, but this is the reality is that it's the other way around. The West is losing its dominance that they've had for at least 5 centuries, and their objective process is underway. It's the course of history that leads to the emergence of new power centers, new powerhouses. The international system needs to be adapted so that there's equal dialogue, cooperation involving those new powerhouses. They need to be part of the decision-making process. But the U.S. is not doing this. It resorts to illegal means, trying to get back their role in international politics that is being eroded. The UN Charter is a very important document. It sets forth a number of rules that have to be complied with. I don't think that we need to modify this document. Although we are in favor of reforming the UN Security Council, that and this process is underway, but we need first and foremost to respect each other, and we need to coordinate our positions. Now, this is something that the US is missing out on, particularly with the current administration in place. Once an initiative from Washington is countered with criticism or with counter efforts, they immediately get angry or start to threaten their counterparts with sanctions. Certainly, the shaping of the multipolar world is a long process. The world economy is growing in cycles, and it's not the West, it's not the US that drives economic growth. It's a painful process. You need to put up with this. But there's no other alternative. But certainly the US is trying to follow an alternative that, and some of their allies, that's ultimatums, and some sanctions. They're trying to punish the European companies, their businesses. The Volkswagen scandal was one example. And again, they use extraterritorial principle of applying their laws. And the Trump administration has taken on some of the legacy, some of the principles from the Obama administration, and they've even become aggressive on some issues. So the U.S. administration is afraid of fair competition in energy supplies to Europe. You're aware of this. Russian gas is replaced by LNG from the U.S., which is several times more expensive. And again, Nord Stream 2 project has been countered by some of the forces. They say that it's used to strangle Ukraine, that it would be bad for Europe. But if you take Germany as an example, it's 2,000 kilometers shorter than via Ukraine, and it's almost two times a little cheaper than via Ukraine. Let's take the defense sector of Russia. We've been severely sanctioned, but the only purpose, and it is clear for me, is to prevent our defense sector from growing. I think you need to have a level playing field instead of banning or pushing third-party countries not to buy Russian weapons or Russian military equipment. Take the media. You have a biased attitude to RT, to Sputnik, and in France we're seeing the same. Russian journalists and Russian media have been banned from Latvia, Moldova, and Ukraine. And just recently, the French president said they need to introduce rules to fight fake news, but there will be one regulator, one party that will define what is fake news and what is not fake news, and there would be no dialogue on that. Take sports. There have been multiple events ahead of the upcoming Olympics. There have been strict measures taken against Russian athletes. I have no doubt, and our president said as much, there have been instances when our athletes have used illegal substances, but there have never been cases before when collective punishment has been used. And clearly it's a way to punish Russia, to hurt its pride, and also to avoid fair competition. And again, I've just given you the examples that you can clearly see on the websites or in media. Russians read this, they analyze this information, digest it. And opinion polls do matter, but I believe the U.S. administration demonizes Russia, and they are mostly responsible for the public opinion that we have today. We cannot, use tit for tat actions always in response to what the U.S. has been doing. We're trying to act in a more balanced way, but we cannot put up with all the illegal actions that the US has been doing. You might also remember the unprecedented story when our diplomatic property was seized, and we are now launching proceedings, court proceedings. Social media users are aware of it, of all those stories. And when these kind of stories are happening, you cannot convince our audience, our social media users, that the US is the best place in the world.
A question from Syrian journalists. Mr. Lavrov, what do you think about eight rounds of Astana talks and the talks in Geneva? Are there any shifts in the positions of Donald Trump and U.S. administration on the Syrian crisis? Thank you.
The Astana talks are covered extensively. We embarked on this process after the failure of the Obama administration to distinguish between the U.S.-controlled opposition from Jabhat al-Nusra and other terrorist groups. President Obama and President Putin met in September in China in 2016. There was an agreement on that. Following that, together with John Kerry, we drafted an initiative, but the US failed to deliver on their commitment. They were unwilling, or they didn't want to crack down on Jabhat al-Nusra, and we still have that fear, and we're getting more and more evidence that this is exactly the case. The UN was idle at that point, and together with Turkey and Iran, we decided to act, to put forward a plan that would rely on the situation on the ground. We started to engage the Syrian armed opposition, and it later met in Astana, in the capital of Kazakhstan, with the Syrian government representatives. Four de-escalation zones were set up in Syria. One is a joint de-escalation zone that was set up with Jordan, the US, and Russia. The level of violence went down drastically. There are some provocateurs in Idlib that are trying to destabilize the situation. The organizations and institutions that signed the agreements on the part of the opposition forces, and they're controlled by Turkey, they are experiencing some additional pressure. And just recently, they had several raids against the Syrian army. And at the same time, there have been some provocations against the Russian air base in Khmeimim, and we had to respond because these were direct violations of the de-escalation agreement. Some of our Western parts are saying that it's the Syrian side that is violating the agreement, but this is exactly the opposite. We very much hope that our Turkish counterparts will complete the deployment of the remaining checkpoints around the de-escalation zone in Idlib. I think they currently have three, but overall there needs to be 20 checkpoints. And we contacted our counterparts in Turkey. They said that they will try to complete the deployment. We hope this will help to resolve the situation. In Ghouta, we have a similar situation. Some of the Western media and Western politicians have been raising a lot of buzz about the alleged operation, alleged offensive of the Syrian army. Again, every step that the Syrian army is taking, it is taking in response to the raids by Jabhat al-Nusra, to the shelling of Damascus, including the districts where the Russian embassy is located, and we cannot turn a blind eye to it. We have to crack down on those illegal actions. So we are moving ahead in line with the agreements. There will be additional humanitarian steps that will be taken, exchange of prisoners of war and other confidence-building measures that will help to launch the national reconciliation process on the ground in those local areas where the escalation zones have been set up. We mentioned it several times that the Astana process is in no competition with the Geneva process, and we always have UN representatives in Astana, and the upcoming national dialogue congress will also contribute to it, and UN Security Council resolution said that UN Security Council resolution 2254 provided for a most broad representation of the Syrian opposition, but what we had in Geneva, those are people who live in Saudi Arabia, on the United Arab Emirates, or in Turkey, or in Russia, or in Europe. So these are people who are emigres. But the Syrian Dialogue Congress will focus on the efforts to launch the political process, and will also engage, most importantly, the opposition figures that are inside Syria, not only those who are against, openly against the Syrian government, but they're also tribal leaders. They are non-combatants, formally speaking, but they live in this country and certainly have a say. So their opinion needs to be taken into account when talking about the future of Syria. Is there any difference between the Trump administration's policy and the Obama administration's policy? I don't think there's any drastic difference. Unfortunately, in both cases, we're seeing that the U.S. is not actually helping to put out the flames of the conflict. They are helping those who are seeking a regime change in Syria. I said it once that Rex Tillerson, just like John Kerry, assured me that the only goal why the U.S. is present in Syria, closing with its navy, with its special operations personnel, and its coalition, is dismantling terrorism, dismantling ISIS. The U.S. Says that there are still hotbeds of violence, there are still pockets of resistance by ISIS. But even if you take it into account, the actions that we've been observing indicates that the U.S. do not want to keep Syria as a state on its current borders. Just recently, we had an initiative that the U.S. wants to help the Democratic Syria forces to set up some border zones, border security zones. What it would mean is that vast swaths of territory alongside the border of Turkey and Iraq will be isolated. It's to the east of the Euphrates River, You know, there are difficult relations between Kurds and Arabs. But if you say that this zone will be controlled by some forces supported by the US, that will be a force of 30,000 people. Well, that's a very big deal. That's a very big. There are a lot of question marks. There is a fear that they are pursuing a policy to cut Syria into several pieces. But again, there's nothing in the UN Security Council resolutions that have been pointing to that, or there's nothing in the previous agreements. So we are expecting clarification from the US on that.
Mr. Lavrov, I represent Kurdistan Media. I have two questions. The first question is also on Syria. The armed forces of Turkey launched at least 40 strikes against the position of Syrian Kurds over the last 24 hours at Afrin. What is Russia's position on this issue? And my second question, on the conflict between Erbil and Baghdad. Conflicts between Erbil and Baghdad continues. Dozens of Kurds have been killed in Kirkuk, and over 200,000 Kurds are now refugees. What role can Russia play in the resolution of the conflict between Erbil and Baghdad? Thank you. The answer to the second question is very simple. Whatever role is acceptable and whatever role both Erbil and Baghdad are interested in, we support Iraq's territorial integrity. We think all problems should be resolved through talks and a national dialogue. If the parties need some kind of a mediatorship, and if Russia is invited as a mediator, we will regard this positively. As regards the situation in Syria, this is a subject on which we should all work together. Specifically, we want ceasefire agreements to be implemented. And of course, Kurds are part of the Syrian nation, and their interests should be taken into account in this work that we now do, including the work we do preparing for the Syrian National Dialogue Congress. But I mentioned that there is a new initiative, new project by the United States to set up this border security forces, relying on the Syrian Democratic Forces with the Kurdish troops. As you know, Turkey responded negatively to that. And I said that we have serious questions as far as the territorial integrity of the Syrian Arab Republic is concerned, but this is also a problem because of the problem between Kurds and Turkey. And the fact that this new project, this new unilateral ultimatum-like step does not help calm down the situation with Afrin.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR, Community Public Radio. I'm your host, Don DeBar.